So stand by for that one.
Did you say stand by?
That was poor.
Schools may nearly be out, but this podcast is back in. And we've been brought back in, not by a sensational transfer news, not a club takeover, but by a sacking. We said when we did our season-ending show in the Hope Tap a few weeks ago that if there was something big, we would come back. And I think a managerial change and the appointment of a former Champions League winner to be Reading's new manager, the first foreign manager in our history, just about fits the criteria as something special enough to bring us back. So you have us back for a one-off summer, early summer special. We're going to do a summer special anyway, but this is an early summer special, just focusing solely on the Brian McDermott sacking and Yap Stam's appointment as his successor. Welcome to the show. Thank you very much for hitting that download button. My name is Dan Wimbush, editor of the Tireless Den, and joining me on this voyage of managerial change is one Johnny Williams. Johnny, hello.
Yeah, I wasn't expecting a summer call-up. I thought we'd all be done for international duty, but it turns out there is some podcasting to be done over the summer.
Yeah, thank you for cancelling your trip to Dubai to be here. I know you've got...
Flew back in the morning.
Yeah, you've also got commitments at Euro 2016 as well. I saw you putting a shift for Wales.
Won the free kick for Gareth Bale's goal, so that was useful.
Yep, good assist. And also, joining me to my right today is Dave Hambags-Harris. Dave, hello.
Not quite up to that pedigree, am I?
No, I've not seen you make an impact yet at the Euros, but there's still time.
Still time. Going to Munich in 2 weeks. So
who would be your...
Celebrate with the Germans when they win it, eventually.
Yeah, you're eligible for a few countries. Who would you be representing at this tournament?
Oh, Christ. What's the right answer here?
England. England, okay, let's go England.
Always the right answer.
Indeed. Right, as mentioned, we are here to discuss Brian McDermott's sacking and Yap Stam's appointment. So this won't be a traditional show in the sense of going through as we usually do with a recap and then pub chat. We will field your questions from the mailbag throughout the show, but basically it'll be an extended long pub chat. We will talk about things like Euro 2016 and North Star naming debates and all that sort of thing when we come back in a few weeks' time, looking ahead to the new season. But for now, this is just a sole focus on the managerial changes. So just after this, we will get right into that.
The Tilehurst End Podcast.
By Reading fans, for Reading fans.
So 17 days ago now, we were just basking in the aftermath of the season. 3 weeks had gone by. I'd just finished recording. Not only are we in the season special in the Hope Tap, sitting down for 2 hours with Dave and Mark, I'd also just wrapped up the season-ending podcast extra with Charles, and one of the topics we discussed was Brian McDermott, and we both chatted away and sort of said, well, it's, you know, 3 weeks now, do you think Brian's safe? And sure enough, we both came to the agreement that, yeah, you know, 3 weeks on, if they were going to make a change, they would have made one by now. And we stopped the record button, went away, I edited it, published it, I think that was on the Wednesday. 2 days later, Brian was sacked. Dismissed in a flurry of activity. There have been a few clues in the build-up. First of all, the pre-season tour plans, they had been cancelled. Then mysterious rumours appear that Yap Stam had been talked to, which had been lined up to fill the managerial vacancy, but there wasn't a managerial vacancy at the time, so that made it even more confusing. And then sure enough, within 24 hours of all that coming to pass, Brian was dismissed by the ownership group. Gents, your initial reaction when you heard the news? Dave, I'll start with you.
Disappointed, but not surprised. Long and short, it was that clearly we know now that they had plans to introduce a new strategy. Shall we say they kind of bumbled along for 2 years, but without any real sort of sense of direction. But they obviously had ideas. Brian McDermott didn't fit in, and Bob's your uncle, out he goes.
Johnny, you were very vocal in your belief that Brian wasn't the right man when he got the job, certainly, anyway. I'm very interested in how you reacted to it all.
I was actually the opposite to Dave. I was not disappointed, but I was surprised. Because, like you say, coming 3 weeks after the season had ended, it was that much was a surprise, in the sense that you'd have thought they'd have made the change straight away, because there were a lot of other clubs like Leeds, like Rotherham, who were also in the hunt for managers, and certainly took a lot shorter time. Blackburn were another, in terms of picking their successor, if you like. So I was a little bit surprised that it took them so long to make the decision. Although at the same time, I wasn't, because we know how long it takes to decision. Look for the mythical green light for Steve Clarke's transfer kitty last summer. But I wasn't disappointed by the decision. I don't think you could see progress with Brian McDermott. I don't think he ever put together a sustained run of form, which you had seen under Steve Clarke and under Nigel Adkins previously. And like I say, my opinions didn't change from the time Brian was appointed to the time Brian was eventually let go. I thought he did fantastically well the first time round, but it was a completely different situation. You couldn't expect lightning to strike twice.
And you know, and just like that, it was ended. We've not really heard from Brian since the decision was made. I'm sure as part of the settlement of his contract, he was probably told to keep a low profile. I'm sure he would have been absolutely gutted at the decision. I had the pleasure of hearing him talk and shook the man's hand at the fans forum not a couple of months beforehand, and hearing him talk that day, the passion he had for Reading Football Club was evident. Whether he had the ability to turn their fortunes around or not, you know, that's a completely different question. But in terms of just feeling for the man himself, knowing his history with this football club, and to see his, you know, come back, it's kind of like a dream for him. He spoke of, you know, how he had, you know, a good job, and he said it in public as well, that he was in a really good place with Arsenal. He was happy, he was enjoying his life, but the lure of coming back to Reading was too strong to turn down. And he took on this challenge again. He rode the highs of the FA Cup run and obviously the painful lows of the dreadful league form that followed. And sure enough, within 6 months, his life's been turned upside down again and he's been dismissed.
Pretty much. I think if I can just follow on from that, I have read an email from an acquaintance of mine who actually sent the club and asked them to forward it on to Brian. And Brian actually personally responded within a day. Wow. And he is genuinely, genuinely gutted.
Yeah,
he felt he had the ability to turn it round. I think from my own perspective, while it's hard to disagree with any of the points that Johnny made, when it comes to proving people wrong and such a club stalwart, I really wanted Brian to be given the opportunity at least to prove those people wrong, and I don't think he ever was really. You know, 6 months is nothing, and it wasn't even 6 months, was it? 5 months is nothing in football, and with a good pre-season, which was looking highly debatable given the supposed financial state of the club. But with a good pre-season, a good solid period of stability, I don't think there's any question that he could have done something. And I hope he's given the opportunity to prove those people wrong at another club. I think if ever he does get another job, then I'll certainly be looking out for those results and backing Brian at every opportunity except when they play Reading.
Yeah, he's been linked with a few different vacancies, a few League One jobs recently. One of those was Bolton, which has gone to another former Reading man in Phil Parkinson. Part of me feels dirty about that. Anyone else? Parky going to Bolton?
Just a strange move as much as anything.
Yeah.
Not necessarily. I can understand him wanting to better himself after, you know, achieving what he has done with Bradford, but it seems a bit of a sideways, if not slowly downward move to Bolton.
Pretty much that. He seemed to be building something at Bradford. He had a good rapport with their supporters. They were on an upward trend. And I think with a little bit more luck, they could have at least done something in the playoffs this season. I mean, obviously they lost the first leg to Millwall, which put paid for to them. But yeah, it's just a very strange sideways move, really.
Absolutely. Well, we're getting back to Brian, you know, as mentioned, hopefully he does pitch up somewhere new. But I think the whole point about, you know, why he was sacked, almost, I don't want to say it wasn't Brian's fault, but there was clearly something in the football club that changed between when Brian was given the job and when he was sacked. Because the way the pieces started moving, they were moving well before Brian actually got the axe. And this was my overall question I wanted to ask of you guys, is who do you think actually made the decision to sack him? Because we've long debated on this podcast, where is the power of this football club? Do you think it shifted? And who do you think it shifted to?
I'm led to believe it's shifted, certainly has shifted, from Pyroj Pyeongpong Sang, is that his name?
Yeah.
To the chap Tiger?
Yes.
Pyroj was the man pulling the strings at the in the pre-season last year.
And is he close to Nurin or to Sesama?
I couldn't tell you that side of things. I generally couldn't.
Yeah. To make it clear, he's not one of the shareholders, though, is he?
No. But he was pulling strings. He was the guy who was pretty much behind some of the transfers last season. It got to a point at the back end of last pre-season where Steve Clark was, in order to sign a player pretty much, he had to pander to the whims of the Tigers. And he was bestowed with players when he did that. If he tried to do his own thing, barriers were put in the way.
I think that's fairly obvious considering some of the lack of appearances we saw from some of the loan signings, especially under Clark.
Exactly. But the balance of power has certainly shifted, and Tiger seems to have taken charge, and he seems to have clearly settled on the Ajax way of doing things, hasn't he? Everything's pointing towards that. Appointment of Brian Tevreden in February, which kind of stacks up to when that shift of power started to take hold and bear some fruit. And of course that kind of started around that time when the performances started to really drop under Brian. So you wonder just how much influence Brian really had. That's not making an excuse for him. I don't really know the ins and outs of the club, but what I do know is that Tiger is pulling strings.
Yeah, Johnny, he came over, didn't he? He watched a game in, was it March or April? And he sat down with Brian and Brian and him talked football. It's clear that he was sort of sizing Brian up in terms of could he fulfil that role and the shift that Dave's mentioned towards this Ajax model. And there's enough clues in the fact of our new manager, our technical director and all the staff that does seem to be very much the model they want to follow. But my question to you, Johnny, is do you think anything would have saved McDermott this season? Do you think if he had won 3 or 4 games at the end of the season, would he still be in a job? Or do you think that it had shifted to the point where they were just going to go through with this in the summer no matter what?
I don't think it had shifted completely. If Brian McDermott had done what he'd done, for instance, in his previous spell at the club, where he went and did some amazing things in the second half of seasons and took us nearly to the playoffs his first season, into the playoffs his second season, and then naturally up the third season, then I think you would still see him in charge. And I think one thing that's being forgotten amongst all the debate about what's happening behind the scenes at board level, at management level, at director of football level, is the fans. And you cannot deny that the fan base was split, as we were in this room, about McDermott. And you can't say that Brian McDermott did anything to win over the fans that were sceptical at the start or didn't want him at the start. If Reading had won 5 games in a row, 6 games in a row, or he's stayed unbeaten for 6 or 7 matches during Brian's time, then some of those fans, or maybe a majority of those fans, would have started to come around to the idea that, oh, Brian still does have it. But I don't think that Brian showed enough to the fans in the end that he was turning things around. And ultimately, the fans are the ones who put the money through the turnstiles, who buy all the refreshments, buy your Carabao for £4 in the in the canteen or whatever it is. And you could see by the end of the season, the fans were leaving early. The fans were so apathetic at matches. We were getting the lowest attendances we've had in, 15 years or so? Since the early days in the Maisky Stadium anyway. So I don't think that Brian showed the fans nor the board ultimately that he was capable of winning everyone around.
No, this did seem like the final roll of the dice from the old Reading era. This seemed like one last chance for Sir John Medeski, Nigel Howe, Nick Hammond at the time to exert their influence before it was gone for good. And again, this is completely anecdotal, but for me, Tiger's obviously seen these results or seen the reaction and just gone, literally, you can just imagine it, can't you? He's read the results or he's watched a video in Thailand, paper down on the desk, right, I'm doing something about this. Mm. As in, he's let other people have their way of doing things and he's decided to make a change. But just going back to Brian, I found looking through the approval ratings that you run, Johnny, on the thelessn.com, fascinating reading, because if you look just out, so sort of 6 weeks into his reign in February, he was given a 2.55 out of 5 rating, which was lower than Steve Clarke when he got sacked. Steve Clarke was at 2.71, which was Clarke's lowest rating by far. Mm. So even when Clarke was doing miserable at the end of the previous season, it was, I think it was just about above three, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was around about the middle. So right from the start, people weren't happy. It then rose dramatically, though. In March, it was up at 3.81. That was on the back of the FA Cup run, getting to the quarterfinals. League form was stable. I think they picked up a couple of wins. And then it went right back down at the end of his reign to 2.66, which, again, sort of backs up the Ties' opinion that the fans weren't happy. But the number I found staggering was that 27% of the voters gave him the lowest possible mark, a 1 out of 5. I don't understand how you can give a man who's been in the job for 6 months, got you to an FA Cup quarterfinal, and, okay, they've not gone near the playoffs, and they've just sort of stayed the course and finished lower mid-table. Is that really deserving, Dave, of the lowest possible mark you can give a manager?
Absolutely not. Which is, which, you know, it just goes to prove that people were... I think people, a lot of people weren't happy from the very start. That's very, very clear. But you've got to give a guy a chance. You've got to give him a fighting chance. And I don't think... and that's where I somewhat slightly disagree with Johnny's point earlier about doing nothing. Some people weren't really prepared to give him a chance unless he won 10 games on the spin or some staggeringly good run of form. And that was never going to happen with the side that we had. The mentality of the squad, and certainly from the fact that, you know, he ended up having Nick Blackman sold from under him, his Orlando Saar sold from under him, who didn't want to stay anyway. So it's there's only one word for it, really, and I think it's pathetic. Anyone who's actually given 1 out of 5 on the back of less than 5 months at that point in the season, it's just, yeah, it's...
Any defence
really,
of that?
Really, really, really.
Any defence of that, Johnny? Could you understand those that wanted to give him a basically a zero, a thumbs down?
In a sense, yes, because the product on the pitch was... And I'm saying, I can't remember what I voted, but I didn't give him a 1. I probably gave him a 2, which is big difference. The product on the pitch was pretty terrible. The results certainly were awful. Like I say, there was no sign of any progress. There was no sign that anything was getting better. And, you know, like I say, I come back to what previous managers had done. They'd at least shown that they could turn things around, get 2 or 3 wins in a row. I think McDermott have maybe... He certainly didn't have 3 wins in a row at any point.
He got 2, I remember, because
I think they had 2 clean sheets in a row against Burnley and Wolves. Both at home, both nil-nils possibly. And, you know, if you just look at where we started when McDermott took over, we were 9th and, we finished 17th.
Yeah.
You know, that's downward progress. And, I mean, you can say that the club is in free fall, the players can't play, but it's the manager's job to motivate them, is it not? And, okay, you know, you have that opposite argument of the players should be able to motivate themselves, but... Then what's the point of a manager? The manager is the one who ultimately, whether it's fair or not, takes the flak for the results, takes the flak for the style of play, takes the flak for just about everything to do with the club. And I think ultimately, you know, McDermott by the end hadn't proven to anyone that he'd done anything better.
I think though, the difference between Steve Clarke and Brian McDermott, or the lack of difference between them, is that, you know, Steve Clarke was lucky enough to have the 6 wins in 7 very early in the season, and in one of the podcasts towards the back end of the season, Wim actually stated that it put us in a very false position, and that's undeniable. Over 46 games, you end up 17th. You deserve to be 17th after what, 10 games in your second. You've still got another 36 games left. You take a look at Steve Clarke this season and Brian McDermott this season, and you put them together, and the one thing that you see is inconsistency between the two of them. Now, Brian McDermott's Reading put in some really, really good performances at times. I remember, certainly in the earlier days, the first 2 to 3 months, the draw at Derby was a very, very good performance. Should have won, didn't win. You can't... This is where I'm going with this. It's basically performances didn't necessarily stack up to the results that the performance deserved. Wolves, when we played them on Boxing Day, I think it was, we should have won that comfortably. We lost 1-0.
Hull away,
exactly. That wasn't Brian McDermott. That was there we go. There's the third guy in charge. There's Martin Cole. We should have won that game, and it was only bad luck and misfortune in that game that did for us. So to put the whole blame on Brian McDermott and not at least give some credence to Steve Clark and the way he managed and conducted himself towards the back end of his tenure, I think it's a little bit folly, really.
Yeah, those quotes made by Steve Clark that we discussed on when he was on Goals on Sunday sofa about the Tyones and their expectations have only ring even more true, knowing what we know now and having seen what we've seen. It is very, very clear now that their expectations are high. They, you know, I did a piece that went up in May looking at the owners so far, and you know, it was said that they expected Nigel Adkins to get in the playoffs in, you know, the season he ended up sacked. They clearly expected Steve Clark to get at least in the playoffs, and the fact that Brian McDermott didn't challenge for it means that all of them failed in their eyes.
I mean, you can see that they have high expectations, because when Nigel Adkins was sacked, I think we were seventh, ninth. We were certainly top half. We were just outside the playoffs
when Steve Adkins was sacked. Weren't we slumping in the table?
We were slumping in the table.
Oh, right? No,
we'd just been thrashed at
three wins in 13.
Yeah, that's right. The 6-0 at Birmingham.
Six one.
Glenn Murray was the one.
Yeah, only five goal defeat.
Where Nigel Adkins said, "Well, there were positive things in the game," as he would. But you can see that they've got high expectations. You can see it from Adkins, and you can see it from Clark as well, sacking him when he's ninth after everything that had happened, admittedly. The one thing that I'm sure we'll come on to discuss, Dan, but if there has been a shift and, you know, there's now not necessarily a queue or a waiting list for everyone to, you know, give the green light to something, then maybe it's all going forward in one direction. That's what you have to hope for.
Yeah, and we'll discuss sort of the next stage of the Reading story and what we're expecting from this point on when we come on to talk about the new manager and Yap Stan. But let's close the book on Brian then. We've spent a good 20 minutes sort of discussing him. A couple of questions to you two. First of all, how will Brian be viewed long term in the Reading history books if you take everything into account? And just, is there any way back now for this man at this football club?
At this football club? I don't think so. How will his legacy be viewed? I mean, for me, I still view his legacy as absolutely amazing in his first tenure here. That doesn't taint the fact of what happened here, whether he was harshly sacked or whether he was deservedly sacked, whether he should have been here in the first place or whether he shouldn't have been here in the first place. I almost think it's just like, you know, it's just the 6 months that you will forget, and you will remember what he did in his first spell in charge, which was nothing short of sensational.
I think pretty much that. For me, he'll always be remembered with fondness, particularly for what he did. You say the 6 months that he's just had, in stark contrast to the 6 months that he had in 2012 and to a degree in 2011 and 2010, the second half of those seasons were absolutely phenomenal. And I've said many a time that second half of that 2009-10 season was some of the most enjoyable football that I've ever seen. I actually, you know, couldn't wait for the next game to go around. There's only one other time I've really felt like that. Perhaps predictably 2005-06. It was football free-flowing. It was football with panache, with style. We scored goals. We looked like we could do something. And, you know, to achieve what he did, when he consistently had the rug pulled out from under his feet with the selling of Sigerson, selling of Long, etc., etc. And then obviously the circumstances with Anton and not being able to sign players for money because Anton had basically mortgaged the club on the likes of bloody Pogrebniak. It's absolutely phenomenal what he achieved at this club. And I could say it again, I'm desperately sad really that he's not been given the opportunity to at least prove some people wrong, because I think he deserved it. He'd been given, when he got sacked the first time round, I think he'd done more than enough to at least be given a second crack at the whip at championship level. And I thought he was going to be given that chance again. Results weren't great. But as I've said about sort of two, three minutes ago, performances weren't too bad until after we went out of the FA Cup. We went on something like 7 defeats in 9. But even then, we had two decent performances, admittedly against a free fall in Forest and Bolton. But I just genuinely thought that he was going to be given the opportunity to do something, and I'm sad that he hasn't been.
Yeah, only two men have ever taken Reading into the Premier League. He is one of them. Only three men have ever taken Reading to an FA Cup quarter final or beyond. He has managed three of those sides, I believe. Is it only one of three men? 27. Steve Clark's run, and then Brian's three quarterfinals.
Yeah.
So he's arguably our most successful manager in the FA Cup, consistency-wise. And his league finishes as well. He took his side to a playoff final, took a side up, and he won a Premier League Manager of the Month award. And ultimately, his team were probably going to get relegated, but he didn't actually have that relegation on his CV. Although I think it would take the most arty of Brian McDermott supporters to suggest he would have taken us out of that tailspin. But regardless, I think record-wise, overall, you could quite easily make the case that he is our most successful manager ever. He certainly stack up there with the likes of Pardew, Coppell and McGee, and obviously going back in time to the likes of Brantford and whatnot.
Maurice Evans.
Yeah, and Maurice Evans. So statistically, he should be recognised as one of Reading's all-time great managers, regardless of what happened in those final 6 months. But maybe I'm just, I don't know, maybe I'm just too enamoured by the man, Johnny. Am I getting carried away?
No, not at all. And yeah, like you said, he's been very, very successful. But like I said, I think when he was first appointed back in December, myself and you, Dan, we wrote opposite sides of why Brian should or shouldn't have been appointed. And the thing I said was, nothing's the same. Everything has changed since 3 years ago. Since 2012 when he was sacked. The players were different, the fans were different, the ownership was different, the mentality of the club was different. And ultimately, you couldn't just expect him, it's easy to say with retrospect, but you couldn't just expect him to come into the club, which had totally changed, and expect him to just carry on.
It was kind of like going back to a pub, which has got the it looks exactly the same on the outside. It might even have the same bar staff and some of the same punters, but the ownership's completely changed. The beer they're doing is different, you know.
Yeah, it's like Pavs. It's like Pavs after they renovated.
Exactly.
Basically.
It's the same place, but it's not the same.
Yeah.
And I only feel sorry because it must have been so heartbreaking for him. Because he went in and obviously he had Nigel Howe, he had Nick Hammond, he had some of the players he'd worked with before. But then he quickly realises that, like you said, everything has changed.
Mm.
And that he wasn't, and when he finally realised, and I'm sure the penny dropped, that he wasn't going to be given a chance to carry on with his with his goals of turning the club back around and having the same success as before. And I just go back to what I said earlier. I'm desperately sorry for McDermott as a person. I don't care what you thought of him as a manager. I don't know a single person in football that has had anything bad to say about Brian. And you just have to look at the outpouring of support he had from former pros and former Reading players to see how respected he was in the game. And I just hope that, as I said, I hope he goes on to have a great career, and I hope he doesn't really sort of resent the club for it, because it would be a shame, because I know that there are probably the majority of fans that only have a lot of respect for him regardless. So Brian, if you do happen to catch this, thank you very much for all you've done for the football club as a manager, as a scout, as a reserve team coach. Who could forget that epic Premier League reserve win at the Madstad? Simon Cox on the score sheet. Alex Pearce as well, maybe? Mm. Possibly. Beat Man, was it Man United?
Was it Bolton we beat?
Bolton, you're right, 2-0.
Yeah. I thought there's a big Irish defender who never played for us.
Pierce
Bennett.
Alan Bennett, you're right.
I'm sure he scored, guys.
That's it. Yeah, there you go. Well, I'm sure we'll be corrected, because this, after all, is an unprofessional joke of a podcast.
Not my statistic of knowledge. I was there.
For your database in the head.
Indeed. So, that does close the book on the Brian McDermott chapter. And again, thank you, Brian. And we will move on. And just after this, we will come on to the new era, the Stam era. So, stand by for that one.
The Tarlhurst End Podcast.
Read the blog
on thetarlhurstend.com.
So it's out with the old and in with the new at Reading Football Club, and it really does feel like a new era for the first time in quite a while, as Yap Stam arrives as Reading's new first team manager. He is the first manager from outside the UK or Ireland to take charge of the football club, and he comes in alongside another couple of Dutchmen in Andreas Alderink and Saeed Bakati, whose names I have no doubt just butchered, so I apologise to you both.
Get off on a good start there.
Indeed. Well, you know, they haven't introduced themselves to me, so, you know.
Exactly. We're quite big time in the Reading and podcast area.
Yeah, they've not phoned into this unprofessional joke of a podcast to say hello, so I do apologise. I'm sure Charles will correct me on the podcast extra on the correct pronunciation of their names. Stam has joined on an initial two-year deal with an option of a third. He was presented to the media today on Monday, June 13th, as we record this in a press conference that also included Tiger, one of our co-owners, as we've mentioned earlier. Sir John Badeski was in there as well, as was Nigel Howe and Brian Teverden, Reading's technical director. Chaps, when Napstam's name was very first floated out, even before McDermott was sacked, what was your initial reaction? Did it get you excited or
worried? Sammy Hoopier was my first reaction. It's got all the hallmarks of Champions League winning central defender absolutely flunking at championship level, which is what Sammy Hoopier did at Brighton. But having said that, it could go wonderfully well. It could have a Jimmy Floyd Hasselbank effect to what he did at Burton Albion, if not QPR. Who knows? Watch this space. Yeah.
Johnny, what did you think when Yap's name...
Like I said, worried. I mean, I'm scared of the bloke. All I remember...
So you're worried for your personal safety rather than...
Yeah, I'm not going to criticise him because, quite frankly, if you are listening, Yap, we're all good. You don't know where I live, I hope.
If you'd like to know where Johnny does live, you can contact us at thetalisend@gmail.com. Sorry, Johnny, carry on.
Oh, no, don't come after me. I was excited, I think, by Yap's arrival. Like you say, it's typically something that little Reading doesn't expect or wouldn't necessarily... has never really had, I don't think. We've never really had that sort of big... Well, Royston Drenthe aside. We've never really had that sort of big name... Someone who I think would probably put Reading on the map, sort of thing. And I know that's something contrary to typically what Reading has done over its, 150 year history nearly. But I think it's something that clearly is in the strategy of the new era, if you like, for the ties. And I think, you know, as long as he can quickly transition into a good manager, then hopefully it could be good times.
The nearest comparison I can make to this appointment, Dave, is that of Tommy Burns, who also came with a big pedigree both as a player and especially as a manager with Celtic, although his time at Celtic was mostly spent in finishing second to Rangers during their long streak of title wins. But Tommy Burns came in with this buzz, didn't he? Came in with a massive name. This guy's come to little old Reading. He's going to bring a load of big names with him and it's all going to work out hunky-dory. And as we all found out, unfortunately for the late Tommy Burns, it didn't work out at Reading. Am I right to make those comparisons?
I think to a degree, yes. The thing with Tommy Burns when he arrived was it, and he admitted soon afterwards that he totally underestimated Division 1 football as it was then in England.
Third tier football. Oh no! It was one at the time.
One at the time. He was. He brought in the Magnificent Seven, didn't he, on transfer deadline day 1998, in the hope that it would just it would help us to maintain safety. In the end, he only won one of his games in charge. Funnily enough, with Jimmy Quinn and Mick Gooding and signing goal and a Bullivant signing goal. I worry with Stam that he'll have absolutely no experience of championship football. There is a formula for getting out of it. It's a massive cliche to say that, but it's so goddamn true. The grind, the Saturday, Tuesday, Saturday, Tuesday, Saturday, Tuesday grind, or Friday, Monday, whatever it happens to be in this day and age, so thank you, Sky, it's something to get over. It's something to work with. You don't get a great deal of time on the training pitch to get your ideas across. I also worry that supporters, if things don't start going right fairly soon after the start of the season, supporters are going to get very touchy. They're not going to have the patience to actually get the idea of to get the ideas that Yapstam is trying to put across to the playing staff. Now, what we've got to remember is that the Dutch way of doing things is very, very different to the traditional English way of doing things. And, you know, let's face it, Reading supporters, they're used to the English way of doing things, the lower league way of doing things. It's only in recent times that we've really started looking at how we do things in a sort of bigger club mentality. And so I worry for the patients if things don't start going right. But if he can hit the ground running, or if he can start, you know, getting results fairly soon, then it can only bring positivity, can't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Johnny, the last man to come in here and really talk about a change in philosophy was a certain man, speaking of Celtic managers, Brendan Rodgers. Now, Brendan came in with a big idea, and this whole talk of a new era, the Steve Coppell era, had been pushed away. And Brendan came in with a big book of ideas. Literally, he had a big book of ideas. His bumper book of tactics.
I'm sorry to laugh.
The Brendan Rodgers methodology.
Yeah, the methodology. He came in with, and again, it came in with a massive pedigree.
Haven't seen the Liverpool version yet.
No. Well, he had the envelopes, didn't he, on being Liverpool of, I'm going to put the name of the worst player in the squad in this envelope and don't let it be you at the end of the season. How that worked, I don't know. Anyway, I digress. But Brendan Rodgers came in. He came in with a new philosophy. Again, an approach to bring through youngsters, to play a new way of football, and to really take Reading on to the next level. We all know how that ended up. Have you got any fears that the same might happen to Stan?
I think you always have to. But I think now you've got... It's like I said, it's a different situation. You've seen now that Reading have finished, what, 19th and 17th in the last two seasons. The previous, when Brendan Rodgers had come in, we had just finished in the playoffs, just lost to Burnley the previous year. So it was a squad that was, in theory, capable of at least a top half finish, if not challenging around the playoffs. This is now a very different squad, and I think fans, or I hope fans, are now seeing that, yes, despite 7 wins in a row from Steve Clarke, and yes, despite whatever we may have achieved in the FA Cup over the last 2 or 3 seasons, this is a squad, especially with all the outgoing loans and all the outgoing players, that needs rebuilding. And so I think and I hope that they'll be prepared to give him the time to rebuild, to put his ideas in, not only on the pitch, but behind the scenes as well, if they're going with the whole Ajax model. And I think it's the last 2 years will have been a bit of a reality check. And, you know, we have, if you like, been overachieving for our history in the last few seasons. And now this is where we are.
See, I think that's rose-tinting the Rodgers approach slightly, because if you look at that squad that Rodgers had, and you had a very young Alex Pearce, you had Scott Davies in the team, you had a very young Hal Robson-Kanu, a Simon Church, a lot of younger players mixed in with the odd little bit of quality. You know, you still had a Kebe there, you still had a relatively good goalkeeper in Federici, but it was still a big building process, and fans didn't give him that patience for me, Dave. They never really got on board. They were bored instantly. I remember that home game against Nottingham Forest. Lots of nice passes, lots of sideways passes.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. And I'll openly hold my hand up now and say that I was one of those people who didn't give him the time. Hindsight's a wonderful thing. Probably should have done. I think he's gone on to certainly prove himself to a degree at Swansea, although he didn't have to do any groundwork there. Prove himself to a degree at Liverpool, although he didn't have to do any groundwork there. The clubs that he's actually done well at, he's had it all set up pretty much for him. He couldn't do it at Watford, although he had a good run of form at Watford. He only had 6 months there before deciding he wanted to come to us, and then he was only given 6 months here. I think...
Do you agree with Johnny, though? Do you think fans are going to be more patient this time around?
Can I just add, because we have had the last two seasons we've had, not because, like with Brendan Rodgers, we'd just been in the Premier League, got relegated, and then got back to the playoffs the previous year, where you'd set a higher bar for the club.
Expectations fallen to that point where they will be prepared to put up with 6 to 9 months of growing pains?
I think it all depends on what happens between now and the start of the season, or certainly the end of August. If we start signing players of repute, then no, he won't have that patience. But if we're left with a starting lineup that includes Aaron Tishbowler, that includes Dominic Samuel, that includes Craig Tanner, etc., 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 I think they'll have absolutely no choice but to be patient. And I'd be extremely disappointed if they weren't.
And this is a point that I frequently make about youth players. If you put four or five youth players into the team, you know, when it gets towards the end of the season, you say play the youngsters, give them a bit of time. You have to be prepared, because there's a reason that these youngsters are out on loan or in the reserve league, and that's because they're not good enough for the championship, or at least chucking four or five of them into the team isn't good enough for the championship. So if that is the case, then you'd have no choice but to be patient.
I think what we've also got to remember is that if it does turn out that we're playing four or five youngsters in the youth team, in the first team, sorry, if we start giving them stick, it could make or break their careers, because you know it's potential players who could move to a higher level in a poor side lose confidence, lose faith in their own ability. It could affect their future transfer prospects, if you know, or certainly their future prospects at Reading.
Yeah,
we've got to remember that. It's absolutely crucial that we give them time.
Well, youth seems to be a massive focus of this new era, and it's particularly interesting with Stam's appointment, because Stam's background, we all know about the glittering playing career with the likes of Lazio, Manchester United, and the Netherlands. But his coaching career, mostly so far, has been at youth levels and lower down in the Dutch football system. Most recently with Ajax's academy and Young Ajax, who basically Young Ajax, they play in the second tier of Dutch football, where he's been a co-coach alongside the man who he's just brought in as his number two, Andreas Oudronik, whose name I've once again butchered. The pair of them have worked for a couple of seasons there. Last season they finished ninth. They won 13, drew 11, lost 12, scored 59, conceded 57. So pretty much your textbook definition of an average season. So nothing there, and nothing from his entire coaching CV really, is screaming, this is a man that's ready to make the step up. He's got no real managerial experience of a team that is not serving another purpose. So that'll be very interesting to see what he does there. But the very fact he has been working with youngsters does bode well for Reading, because they are going to rely on a lot of young players. We've got the likes of Jordan Abita, Jonathan Bond in goal. You've got Jake Cooper. You've got Tishbowler, you've got people like Aaron Cool, Tariq Fosu, Dominic Samuel, even to a certain extent players like Rackles, who are still not massively old. Craig Tanner coming back. You've got lots and lots of young players. And I just wonder, does this point towards a deliberate strategy now that Reading are going to go gung-ho?
I think what it points to...
On the youth system.
It's obviously a very, very deliberate ploy to do that, but it also fits in quite nicely with the... slightly more than rumours, not quite known truth, I suppose you could call it, of the financial situation at the club. The fact of the matter is, we don't have a great deal of money, and we're going to have to go with youth. And so, why not try and model yourselves on one of the best youth academies that the world has ever, the football world has ever created? It seems to make perfect sense to me.
And especially with the mooted plans to let Category 1. Academies sort of get more involvement with league clubs. I mean, I don't know whether that had any, you know, effect on the decision. I don't know how long that was sort of in the pipeline and how long chairman or higher up members knew about it. But it certainly could be advantageous, especially for a club like Reading that is below the Premier League, if we stay below the Premier League, where youth players almost have more of a route to the first team, because they sort of... they could come to a club like Reading and think, oh, well, I'm more likely to get into a championship team if I play well than get into Man United, Arsenal, Chelsea's team. You know, I mean, you look at Chelsea, they've got, 60 players out on loan. You look at
Reading... I think it's quite 60, but I think it's higher.
It's a fair amount.
About fair.
But yeah, and that is pure speculation. I literally only just thought of it, but that could be another reason why they are going after this youth model, because it does, in theory, if you're a lower club with a Category 1 academy... you're still playing the same teams, but as a player, you've got more of a chance to make it.
I think that absolutely rings true, because in order to actually play in the first team at a club like Chelsea, then you have to be Chelsea standard.
Yeah, world class.
Yeah, well, yeah, you've got to fit in, you've got to be up to that standard.
Or you have to prove yourself for 4 or 5 years out on loan.
Yeah. Yeah.
And just bringing in through that youth focus, it does make sense to give someone like Stam a job because he does have that experience. And the other point as well that a lot of people are saying, and they're looking to him mostly based on his career as a player, although we have got an opinion from an Ajax fan, which you can go read up on the Talisten.com that talks about this, is that, you know, his one-to-one nurturing of players is supposedly good. And obviously he's got that fearsome reputation. You know, you joke, Johnny, that you weren't going to mess with him. But I think that does ring true to a certain extent, that players aren't going to mess about with him because they know he was no nonsense. He was no nonsense as a player. And I don't think he's changed very much in the intervening years. Is there a feeling that Stam is a person that's going to get the very most out of limited resources in a way that maybe a Brian McDermott couldn't?
It's hard to say because, like you said, we really don't know how he's going to pan out as a manager. But you would project that he has that, almost that fear factor, or almost that motivational factor, like someone like Neil Warnock. You know, I hate myself bringing up that comparison because, you know. But Neil Warnock has a knack of getting the best out of limited resources because he looks terrifying. Now, I'm not saying that Jaap Stam, purely based on his looks, will manage to keep a championship side in the championship, but he looks like the sort of person who, at the very least, can motivate a side in order to get them to achieve something with limited resources.
He's a winner, though. That, for me, is very important, Dave. He's okay, you might not have the most glittering managerial CV, but if you look in the dressing room and you're looking at a bloke who you know has won Premier Leagues, who's won Champions Leagues, who's played at World Cups, European Championships, and he tells you to do something because it's going to make you better, I do think there is something to say that a player is going to pay more attention than a guy who's, I'm sorry, Brian, looks like a celebrity chef and had a playing career that was very brief in the 70s and then managed Slough. And had a bit of success with Reading.
And played for Oxford, let's not forget.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm not putting Brian down, don't get me wrong. And hopefully the first half of this podcast showed how much I think of him.
He turned off after the first half, didn't he?
He did.
Wanted to hear you.
But you know exactly what I mean, don't you? If Brian McDermott keeps banging on at you at something and you're maybe not paying attention, thinking, oh, well, what does he know? Yeah. You're not going to think that with Yaps now.
I think, absolutely. I think his pedigree is absolutely second to none, certainly playing pedigree anyway. He's played, as you say, for some of the biggest clubs on the planet, Man United, AC Milan, include PSV in there. They're, you know, obviously one of the big Dutch clubs in Europe. So you kind of think that he knows a thing or two about defending, certainly, and so, well, playing the game, shall we say. Hopefully that can show itself out on our own players and out on the pitch.
Does that reputation, Johnny, give him more of a leash with the fans? Does the fact that he is such a big name give him a bit more time with the fans that they might not have given, say, another random European coach to come in who maybe didn't have such a playing history? If the results are the same, does Stam get more time just because he's Jaap Stam?
It's hard to say no. I mean, your reputation is a big thing in football, especially in football. And I think, you know, absolutely the fact that that this is, like you say, a Champions League winning centre-back, a man with a great pedigree, speaks very well, looks like he's, you know, knowledgeable, seems to understand the job he's taken on, hopefully with that little bit of realism that, yes, this is a guy who is entering his first senior management role, if you don't count Young Ajax. I think the fans hopefully will be patient with him because, you know, I mean, we've run an initial sort of poll of how happy people are with the appointment of Jaap Stam. It's around about the same as it was of when Brian McDermott was appointed, around the sort of 60, 65, 70% mark. But I don't get the feeling that there will be as much negative. I feel the negativity will be pointed more towards the owners than the manager if things start to go wrong.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely agree. Because they've basically wasted 2 years, haven't they?
Yeah.
With just sort of bumming around, making a decision here and there without any prior forethought. Now that they seem to be developing a way of doing things and a way forward, you'd hope that they'd give it the time required. But if they don't give it the time required or things don't start, you're absolutely right. Then the daggers are going to be out for them rather than the manager.
And that brings me probably to my biggest point of this entire show, you know, we've spoken for 50 minutes on the men managing the first team squad, but for me, all of this is to show me is the responsibility and the buck now has to stop with the owners, and these owners have to now run this football club. They have got rid of the people that were running it before. Nick Hammond is gone. Ryan McDermott, a man with 15 years of experience at the club, is gone. So Don Medeski is all but gone.
Mm.
Especially
after the press
conference. Indeed. For those of you who didn't hear it, Sir John Medeski made no secret of the fact that he didn't want Brian McDermott gone in the first place. Although, to his credit, he wasn't saying anything bad against Stam. He just said, I didn't want to get rid of Brian, but the shareholders disagreed and I respect their decision. But anyway, so he's on the way out. Mm. The old Reading way, as we said earlier, is basically dead. So now the buck's going to completely stop. You can't now go back and blame... It's harder now to go back and blame Zingarevic because all of his rotten contracts are gone. You can't go and blame Sir John because his era is long gone. And you now can't blame managers because they've sacked three of them. Mm. So at this point, it's them. They are the ones that have got to carry the can. If things go wrong, they have run out of people to blame. And they've got to do some managing of the football club. You know, we... Book with Charles every week on the podcast section. He is asked week in, week out to speak to these people. They don't want to speak. All we hear from them is the odd little bit. I think Tiger said about three or four sentences in the press conference today. And they put out that pathetic statement at the end of the season. We point out at the time, didn't mention Brian McDermott, and that proved ultimately telling.
But it did prove their knowledge of the League Two playoffs, though.
So oh, absolutely. So now they've got to do managing. They've got to manage this football club. They've put their plan in place and they've got to see it through.
Unless they change their plan in another 6 months.
Again.
Yeah.
And the plan needs money. It needs investment. Not just money, but it needs time. And my nagging feeling is, it's this Game of Thrones style scenario of who, we talked about it earlier, who is in control. Now it's Tiger. Does there come a bit where either Tiger gets bored? Or does one of the other... I mean, technically, he's not the majority shareholder. That is Nurin. Does Nurin suddenly get an advisor in that knows a lot about football and starts whispering in his ear saying, oh, I don't know about this model. I know this guy. He can bring us in these players. Let's get him in. Does he suddenly put his foot down? Does Lady Sassima find somebody who, you know, is offering her advice? Does Nigel Howe suddenly start to get more power back? I'm still very, very concerned about the overall management of this football club. And to their credit... not to their credit, to give them a fair shot, it's the start of something.
Mm-hmm.
It is the very start of this process, and it could be the best process ever. We could be on a Bournemouth-Swansea-style journey, and we're all sat at 3 years from now thinking, what a decision, great move. But we could be looking at a football club like Charlton, who had owners who wanted equally grand things, and we've seen what's gone on.
Yeah.
There in recent years. So how much pressure now do you think is on those owners, Johnny?
Plenty. And I think, well, certainly in the next few days, we're going to be running our ownership approval ratings. Again, rate them from 1 to 5. But there's plenty of pressure on them because with Sir John, he was always there. He was always, you always get the feeling that you could trust him. Obviously, we've got through the time with Anton where he did a runner and left us up the creek. But now what you expect or what you'd like from these owners is openness. And with everything that's gone on, you don't see that openness, especially with the development of Royal Elm Park, if that goes through, if the environmental agency doesn't mind trees and shade and lakes or whatever they're complaining about.
We'll come
about.
On to that later this summer, don't you worry.
Yeah, I'm sure we will. There does seem to be ulterior motives.
Dave, how are you feeling about the ownership situation at the moment?
Uneasy. Based on what I've heard.
You touched on it, Johnny. The big thing is Royal Elm Park, isn't it? Because that is going to take... It does have the potential to bring them in tens of millions of pounds, but it's also going to cost them, in the short term, hundreds of millions to develop. And they've got to have that money ready to go. And presumably, while that money's tied up in the property deal, like you say, they can't be pumping it into the football club for signings.
No, exactly. And it's you take a look at the Bearwood Lake situation as well, where building workers have pretty much all but stopped by all accounts. All the money that they've got is obviously tied up in Royal Elm Park. Which I'm led to believe they bought the land for 11 million quid.
The way that the balance sheet is recognised from the old holding company, which technically owned all the ground, suggests that it was 11 million pounds. It's all accounting mumbo jumbo to me, but yeah, it basically 11 million pounds is what it was listed as being worth. So they've transferred those assets for 11 million for a site that's probably going to generate hundreds of million.
Yep. Seeing as Badesky bought it for a pound, that's not a bad turnover for him.
Well, it depends. I don't know. The situation in regards to how much Sir John actually received for the club, again, we're not really sure. He got his loans paid back for all, but I think there was a few million left in at the end.
I only meant it as a simple joke. I didn't mean it
as
an analysis of...
That's been an accusation levelled at Sir John, that Sir John has made hundreds of millions, well, tens of millions of pounds out of this football club.
To a degree, yes, he has, but he built it up. All the loans that Sir John bestowed on the club were interest-free, so he didn't make any money out of those. It was money that he was putting in for the good of the club. And ultimately, for the good of himself when he sold it. The land around Elm Park and the club itself wasn't exactly valued very highly when he bought it in 1990, was it? So, you can't blame him for wanting to build a club up. It's fairly clear. It's becoming, more and more clear as time goes on that the ulterior motive is Royal Elm Park and the sheer vast amount of money that is going to bring in for the shareholders.
Is it harsh there? Because are we being slightly harsh to the new owners by saying ulterior motive? And because we do have a tendency, and I'm as guilty as anybody else, of having a bit of a negative inflection with this, because their stated intention is that the whole idea behind Royal Elm Park is to bring in more revenue, to make the Medeski a more attractive place for fans to come, and the Sassamer has said that for money that will be ploughed back into the town, and she mentioned, and the football club. Mm. So while we may be being a little bit too hasty here, should we not be more supportive of Royal Elm Park, be hoping everything goes right, because the money's going to go back to the football club?
I'd make two points. Well, one point is a question. If you're making the money off Royal Elm Park, bearing in mind the financial fair play rules, could you generate that money as income for the club as part of the company?
No, you would only be allowed to put in, as it wouldn't matter where the money came from.
Yeah.
You're still only allowed to put in a certain amount to balance the books.
But if Royal Elm Park is not part of that company.
No, because it's not part of football club trading. So you can't just say, oh, we made £200 million on a property deal, so we get that money.
Sure. So, even so, you still do have this FFP of, what is it, £15 million loss over 3 years or whatever that is. So
is it 39 now? I think over 3 years it's gone up to.
Well, yeah, that in a sense limits how much you can put into a club, and you're seeing clubs like, I think, Nottingham Forest under transfer embargo this season, and I think there's another club that
Fulham were under it, I think.
Leeds may have been as well.
Yeah, since Blackburn were, I think they've come out of it now.
And the other point I'd make is, okay, there were a lot of loans, but the Thai owners did invest in the club. They spent £2.5 million, if you like, on Matty Vidra, plus a Premier League player's wages. You'd imagine that Ola John was on a tasty little wage at Benfica. Michael Hector, when he came back, as long as we were paying his wages, he was probably on a decent wage. Lucas Pierzon as well. I don't think it's fair to say that the Thais haven't spent money. Sure, they haven't tied up money long-term into the club. But then, had we signed Ola John for, 40k a week for 3 years, we'd be in the same situation as we were with Pogrebniak and Williams and all these other players that have been brought in on extortionate contracts. It would just be more and more.
I think what you've got to remember, though, is that at the back end of 14-15, we were still perilously close to transfer embargo. You've got to remember that even at the back end of that season, this is the key statistic within the accounts, was the wages, the salaries to turnover, which was 96%.
Mm-hmm. And that's with parachute payments.
That's with parachute payments, which took into account the likes of a full season of Pogrebniak. It took in half a season of Royston Drenthe, because I'm led to believe Sheffield Wednesday paid a pittance towards his wages. And all the other Anton Zingarevich contracts that were on the club at the time. The money that it seems to me that the money that we saved from those players that were released at the end of 14-15 and halfway through was all put towards a very short-term approach. Ended up with 6 loans. There weren't, as you say, there weren't exactly low-cost players, and so for every Pavel Pogrebniak that we released on free of charge, just to free up the wages, we signed a Lucas Pearson and an Ola John, which pretty much probably cost the same amount, roughly the same amount. So I wouldn't be surprised to see if we had a similar balance sheet at the end of this season when they eventually get released in December. And just it'll be interesting to see the comparison, really, because I want to know just how close we are again to a... Because over the last 2 seasons, we've been, you know, there have been serious questions asked around that time. Are we going to be under a transfer embargo? Are we going to be under a transfer embargo? I've been reassured, and we've, you know, that it's not going to happen. And we've just pulled through it at the skin of our teeth. I'm not so sure about this season, but we'll see.
I don't know. I think the January signings went a long way. I don't think they would have signed a Kermigan if they were in danger, because I don't think there was a realistic playoff chance at that point, and I think they would have literally been in complete.
It makes it interesting, though. Sorry to interrupt. It does make it interesting, though, that that the owners signed Dennis Rackles instead of reportedly spending £3 million on Connor Washington.
Mm. Mm. I mean, these are stories, and these are unsubstantiated things. But again, I'm sorry if you are close to the Thai owners, or one of the Thai owners who happen to be listening to this podcast, come out and tell us. And this is it. Come out and tell us what your financial situation is. Come out and tell us how much money you put into the football club. Put our fears to rest. But this whole secrecy thing, oh, it's not secrecy, but this whole lack of transparency.
I think it's more a fear, because with the exception of the Peterborough chairman, you don't get, and perhaps David Gold and Sullivan, you don't get many chairmen or women or owners openly talking about finances, unless you're a company like Manchester United, where they float on the stock exchange. I think it's more the fear that has been put into us by what has happened in recent years that is making us so uneasy. It would be fine if we knew that the owners were present, were contactable, were visible, and without saying they don't, we knew that they had the club's best interest at heart.
But like Dave said, though, January is interesting because they didn't put the foot down on the accelerator if they had the money there to invest, or if there was
the space to invest.
But this is just it. And this is the ultimate question: is it a case of space? So have the owners not been putting extra money in because they can't, because they'll fail financial play rules, or is it because, like some stories are going around, they actually don't have a lot of free cash at the moment? They're obviously very cash asset rich. I mean, they're very successful. They've run very successful businesses that are public knowledge. So they're clearly... But then, like Sir John was worth 400 odd million at one stage, but that didn't mean he had £200 million to go splashing on players.
I think point A that you raised is something that is almost forgotten by some fans, is that the FFP rules dictate that you can't just go out and blow £10 million on a player, because then you can't buy anyone. I think, again, I'm only speculating, but I would imagine that a club like Derby might be close to a transfer embargo next year, because you look at how much they've spent in recent seasons. They must be close to that sort of threshold of going over.
And let's not ignore the fact that if Bournemouth had stayed down, I think they would have been under a transfer embargo as well.
Yeah, but they've had to pay a fine.
The thing is going forward is that these, and again, unfortunately, these are only a wait and see thing, but the financial fair play rules have relaxed. So I think it is now £39 million over 3 years you're allowed to lose, including a certain amount of owner investment. So the arguments are slimming down now for owners not putting money in, and it was specifically for that. Clubs like Derby and Bournemouth were arguing, our owners have got the money, they're prepared to put their own money into the football club, why are you punishing us? The whole idea behind financial fair play is to stop clubs overspending. And as long as this is money that owners do then not want back, and that is the key point here, it's that owners don't saddle clubs with debt. They can saddle themselves with as much debt as they want. But the financial fair play thing is a whole another can of worms. So we will have to wait and see how much money they are putting in or not putting in to the football club. But as I said, it's a wait and see approach. Anyway, that just about covers. Have you got any more thoughts on Stan before we come on to the mailbag?
I don't just want to say any more in case I offend him.
It's very true.
Start winning.
Okay. Well, we will. We've got a brief mailbag, and then we will wrap up the show. So stay tuned.
Get social with the boys.
Find them on Twitter
at the Tarlhurst End
and facebook.com/the Tarlhurst End.
So let's start the mailbag off with the most pertinent question. And thank you, obviously, to those of you who have submitted your questions to at the Tarlhurst End on Twitter, thetarlhurstend@gmail.com for the emails, and to facebook.com/Tarlhurst End. Very much appreciated. As mentioned, the most pressing question comes from Matt Waller. Just his question to the club: what the F is going on? And the F word was a rather naughty word. And I think we've tried to answer that in the last hour and 10 minutes. So hopefully, Matt, we've answered your question.
But probably not.
No?
I imagine that there's a lot more questions still to be answered.
If you do know what the F is going on with the football club, please let us know. Royal Hoops, one of our assistant editors, Steve, who appears frequently on this very podcast, asked, if rumours about the club copying the Ajax model are true, what do you think about it? We kind of touched on that with Stan, but from watching, you do watch a lot of Dutch football, Dave, and you've seen a lot of Ajax and that sort of model. Is it something to aspire to? We all know the stories of Ajax from, you know, in the Cruyff era and even in the mid-90s with the Kluivert era, but does the model still work in 2016?
To a degree, yes, it does. But obviously, football finance is such now that it's so heavily weighted towards big leagues, Spanish, English, Italian leagues. There isn't really a great deal of money in the Dutch leagues. The only money that really comes in is to the clubs that end up in the Champions League, and they are almost inevitably Ajax and PSV. Feyenoord occasionally challenged, but they're not up to the level that PSV and Ajax are at the moment.
But will it be an effective model of football in the Championship? Can that free-flowing football sort of really make an impact in the rough and tumble 46-game season?
Well, there's only one way to find out, isn't there? And that's to watch Amsterdam this season. I was racking my brains earlier today thinking of a Dutch manager in the Championship that has a similar sort of background to sort of an Ajax background or PSV background, and I can't think of any. So it's almost uncharted territory in English football. It's certainly English second-tier football.
Although I did want to bring up the example earlier, and I regret not bringing it up, but obviously Aitor Karanka is a man who came into English second-tier football with no previous managerial experience beyond working with Jose at Real Madrid, and you know he's just led Middlesbrough to promotion.
Yeah, after what, 2.5 years?
Yeah, and one of those was a playoff final defeat.
There's precedence there from across Europe. Is the Dutch model best suited? The actual Dutch model of football? I'm not entirely sure it is. But the good thing with Ajax and sort of Feyenoord and PSV, when you watch them, certainly with their younger players. I watched Ajax a few times in Europe, and they're so comfortable on the ball. Even though they're substandard, you know, they are ultimately substandard at that level. They're not going to win too many games in Championship, Champions League. But you watch them; they're so comfortable on the ball. They're quite happy to trust each other when in possession. They're quite happy to pass the ball to a player who has an opposition player in the vicinity of him, or one or two, but they just know where the space is. It's intrinsic in the Dutch psyche. But whether or not, in the rough and tumble, high-paced, high-pressure grind of a Championship season, whether or not that actually works, I'm not entirely sure.
I think this is a bigger question for me, Johnny. Is how capable are the bones of this squad at the moment capable of playing that football? Do you have confidence in the likes of Jordan Abita, a Tishbola, a Dennis Rackles, a Jan Kermigan, a Chris Gunter? Do you think that this group can adapt?
That's a difficult question. I think at the youth level,
Those youth players will be easier to mould, not only because, you know, they're younger, they haven't quite got set in their ways yet as professionals, but also because if you watch the youth games, they do play that very much possession-based, floor-based style of football, if you like, the new breed, the new wave of football. So I think in that sense, you know, it could work. But like I said earlier, you cannot expect 4 or 5 19-year-old, 20-year-old, 21-year-olds to be thrown into a team when they weren't even anywhere near the team last year and expect everything to click straight away. In terms of, I don't know if Hoops are talking about the club model, i.e. sort of off the pitch behind the scenes. Again, like I speculated earlier, if you can prove to prospective youth players that you are their best chance of getting first team football, whether it be here or elsewhere, then absolutely I think it can work. Because I think as long as we are at this level, if you like, and do maintain the Category 1 status, then we hopefully, despite the less prestige, could be one of the more attractive propositions for players who actually want to play rather than play for a big club.
Yeah.
And as for Dutch football working, I look forward to watching the Netherlands next game at the Euros.
Well, indeed. Daniel Harrington, cautiously optimistic for next season, hopefully a new direction for the club. Simon C commenting before Stan was appointed, can't believe the appointment of a new manager has turned to a farce again. It did take a while, didn't it? It's, as I said, we are over nearly 3 weeks after Brian's sacking and the first rumours of Stan talks. It has taken a while. Hugh asked an interesting question. Looking into the crystal ball, how will the club look in 5 years? More likely to go up or down?
I think we had this question at the end of the season, didn't we?
Yeah.
Possibly.
But it's a new era, Johnny. It's a new... Everything's changed.
I'll give it the same thought and answer that I gave to the very first question in the mailbag. F knows.
Okay, yeah. Yeah. Exactly the same. I do not know.
I'd say down. Still down.
Even with this new model?
Yeah. We're nearer going down than we are going up.
Right. Okay. Jack Killick, I'm quietly confident about Stan at the helm. Obviously has the knowledge, but do you think his lack of experience will cause problems for us next season? Sort of covered that. I'm fascinated to see what happens when it starts. Sounds so horribly cliche, but if it's a tough period over Christmas and they lose 3 or 4 games on the bounce, fascinated to see how he deals with that. And if that sheen that we talked about, that respect for him as a defender, if that starts to fade and players start to see little bits of weakness, because let's not forget, the players here have now very much got it on good authority that these are sack-happy managers, sack-happy owners, because they've sacked 3 managers. So there is an argument to be made that the mentality and the die has been cast amongst people at this football club that if things aren't going well, the players aren't going to carry the can, because we haven't seen wholesale turnover of players. It's going to be the manager. Now, if 4 or 5 of your mates suddenly not start playing for the manager, you want a bit of a change. I don't know. Johnny, do you think has it set a bit of a negative precedent?
Yeah, I think it has. And I think, you know, Reading, probably for just from the outside, is becoming sort of, you know, certainly getting lower down the ladder. If you're a player and you've got a choice of, say, Reading or another lower championship club, you might look at that ownership situation and think, well, the manager who I signed for isn't necessarily going to be the same guy. But I do think that, you know, reputationally, I hope that Stam could keep that group together.
Right, moving on. Matt Castle, I think that McDermott had a probation period in his contract, which meant we could terminate him for a minimal fee if he failed to perform. If he didn't impress them in their talks following those business performances, then what do they base their argument on him staying on? In regards to the new direction we appear to be going in, I'm cautiously optimistic, but also need to remember that these things take time. I guarantee you that Swansea and Southampton fans aren't clinging on to their old ways anymore. Now, the key difference here for me with those football clubs, and the same goes with Bournemouth, and the same goes with a lot of these clubs, is they built in the lower leagues. Swansea built from the bottom tier. Bournemouth virtually built from the bottom tier. Southampton had to go down to League One and face a points deduction, and before they were taken over by a wealthy consortium and built up. There's not a load of success stories that start in mid-table championship. That certainly that spring to mind. Stoke maybe, but even then they spent time in.
They were in with us, weren't they?
Yeah,
they were knocking around with us for I think sort of 15 out of 16 years, and they got after we got they got relegated in 91, I think it was, something like that. I mean, even after their move to the Britannia, I mean, their first season at the Britannia, they were relegated. We did the double over them, and that was remarkable in itself, given that Bullivant and Burns' first season. You're absolutely right. I mean, Swansea, like I say, they started really building under Kenny Jackett. It was 2004-05. We played them in the FA Cup that season.
Mm.
And they wiped the floor with us in the first, you know, in the first one, well, in over 90 minutes in the replay there. They were really, really good. And that really set the foundations there in 2004. And it took them, what, 6 or 7 years? But it was 6 or 7 years of patient progress. You know, likewise, Southampton, they, like I say, they got relegated to League One, points deduction. I mean, thinking about a point that I've just made earlier about a Dutch manager in League One, a second tier English football, Southampton, the season they got relegated in 2008-09, appointed Jan Portvliet.
Ah, yeah.
They beat us at the Medeski.
Bradley Wright Phillips.
Bradley Wright Phillips twice. Jimmy Kebbe's first goal for us as well.
Mm-hmm.
They, bizarrely enough, despite their poor performance throughout the whole season, Portvliet absolutely annihilated Steve Coppell that day tactically. They had us all ends up. They thoroughly deserved their win. So I suppose they could have a precedent there. But they said they had to go down before they started going up. Leicester City, again, they went down to League One. They took a slightly different, or say slightly different, a fundamentally different approach to it, in that they just chucked money at it in the end.
Brighton, exactly the same. Brighton. Sheffield Wednesday.
Brighton have got it absolutely nailed on. There is a lot of good going on at Brighton. It pains me to say, I really don't like them. but there is a lot of good going on. They've got so much right at that football club, and it is a matter of time before they actually establish themselves in the Premier League the way they're going at the moment. Hull, similar. They started building the KC Stadium when they were in League Two. They got promoted to League One. Within a season or two, they were promoted to the Championship. 2008, they got promoted. They're another club who've done exactly the same. So, you know, the models are there, but they, you know, the models are generally of clubs that have fallen on or started from tougher times.
No, they're basically rock bottom.
Yeah.
So they've got a blank canvas to work off because it can't get any worse.
Yeah. And the momentum.
There aren't many clubs that, like you say, that start off from sort of mid-table, lower mid-table, dropping down.
And this is what Reading fans of clubs. And what Reading fans need to realise, things can get worse. A lot of fans are saying this is the worst football I've seen, and a lot of fans, I'm not just going to go on a youth bashing thing here because this has got nothing to do with youth, it's just, you know, you can't help when you're born, but there is a generation of fans now that have known nothing but upward progress. This club has been nothing but upwards, or at worst sideways-ish, for what are we talking, 15, 16 years now?
Yeah. Admittedly, yeah. Since for the last 3 or 4 seasons, it's been trying. It's been testing. Certainly, with the first that season in the Premier League, but you know, 2000, probably the only real downward spiral that they experienced was 2007-08.
Even that's playing Premier League football. What I'm saying is, it can get so much worse, as older fans will point out and tell. So, all I'll say to fans is, yes, it's great to have a brand new era, and yes, it's worked in other places, but there's more pain to come. There might be more pain to come, and sometimes, and this is what happened, we go back to Brendan Rodgers. Reading were flirting with relegation, and people panicked. Fans started to panic. The owner panicked. Whoever made the decision to sack Brendan Rodgers is still one of those urban myths. Although I think all of us sitting around actually know the answer, which we can't say in public. But again, the last
pretty much has, hasn't it?
Yeah, well, near enough. I'm not sure for legal purposes though, and I quite like being out of jail. unless you've got one of those get out of jail free cars. The last time there was a new era, it didn't take. Fans got panicky because they thought it could get worse, and they didn't want to jeopardise that Championship position.
I think a lot has to be said for the Brendan Rodgers mentality as well, though, and his general all-round personality. It was all very, very positive stuff with nothing to back it up, really.
Sorry, talk about Brendan Rodgers or Nigel Adkins.
Brendan Rodgers.
They newly unemployed Nigel Atkins again. Yeah. Sorry, Nigel.
Mm. Yeah. There's another club that are going through managers like nobody's business. Sheffield United. I actually put a post on Hobnob the other week. I think it was just in the aftermath of Brian sacking. And Sheffield United, since Neil Warnock left in 2007, that's what, 9 years. I think it's something like 10 managers they've gone through.
Mm.
There's your case in point.
Yeah. And we'll finish the mailbag with Tom, who says, "Hi guys, I think we can all agree Brian McDermott split opinions among fans and certainly caused a lot of trouble on social media, which I'm sure most fans will be aware of. Personally, I've always been a fan of Brian and have supported him throughout his two spells, even receiving a lot of stick and abuse for it on Twitter. It's clear this topic for a while has put fuel on the fire for infighting within the fan base. He genuinely was the kind of character that we needed and would take us on to better things. He knew the club back to front. However, it was a different club to when he knew in his previous spell. I have to concede that his stubbornness with subs, the persistent use of the 4-4-2 diamond, and not using youth when he should have done, meant, sadly, the writing was on the wall. It's very disappointing to see him leave again, as we have lost a great man who had exactly the kind of attitude we require going forward. Now we have Yapstam, a no-nonsense manager that I personally hope people back this time. We are in a period in which the club is incredibly unstable. Times will be hard until things click. This hasn't fully been understood by fans in recent times. It's all about instant success. Things take time. On average, it's taken a Reading manager 3 seasons to gain promotion. I'll support Yap. Hopefully, he'll be given money and a supportive owner and be supported by the fans. Along with this, hopefully, Steve Clarke's situation won't occur if matters worsen. Finally, yes, he hasn't got a great deal of managerial experience, but I feel at a club like Reading, he will grow and become a stronger coach and character than he already is. And then he's written good luck and welcome Yapstam in Dutch, which I'm not even going to try. But thank you very much for that, Tom. And I think he's hit on a lot of the points we've covered in the last sort of hour and a half.
Yeah, absolutely. The giving a manager time thing, I mean, you know, like I say, just look at the bare facts. Reading have finished, 19th and 17th the last 2 seasons. I'm sure if you went through and looked at our books now, we probably have, 11, 12 senior players? Or certainly first team quality senior players. This isn't a squad that is suddenly going to shoot out the table and make a charge.
We have signed Daniel Gravenbach.
Denzel Gravenberg.
I thought it was Daniel.
No, it's definitely Denzel.
It's Denzel. Yeah, the only Falls and Horses connection is there.
You are right. It is Denzel Gravenberg. Well, you know,
Dave, if you like.
Pardon?
We can call him Dave if you like.
Yeah, let's call him Dave. We'll call him Davey G. Denzel Gravenberch. I don't know why I had Daniel Gravenbach in my head. I swear there was a footballer called...
It's Thomas Graverson, but I don't think that's...
I've had a mare, but we are an hour and a half into the show. So again, an unprofessional joke of a podcast, an unprofessional joke of a host. So what are you expecting? We have signed that guy anyway. So, you know, if you can't be excited about signing Dutch second tier defenders on free transfers... Or sorry... Undisclosed fee. There was a fee apparently involved. How can you not
see? The Tice have got money.
Yeah.
There you go.
So, what do you think? 3-4 mil?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
A million baht.
I don't even know how much
a baht
is. 3 or 4 million yen.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, baht's not very much, but.
Well, yeah. So there is a new signing. We'll profile him and all the other ones later in the summer.
You expecting more, are you?
I really hope there's more. Really hope there's more. Right.
It's got Elroy Cromwell written all over it.
No one knew a lot about Ibrahim Sonko before he came in and did really well.
So. Stephen Hunt or Kevin Doyle or Shane Long?
Yep.
Oh, the Reading Way. It was so good, wasn't it?
And Alan Bennett.
And Alan Bennett and Dave Mooney and Brett Williams.
Erica Binner, Chuck and Noelle.
Oh, there's a name.
Yeah, Sadiq Baraj.
Sekou Baraji.
Who can forget except for me, because I've forgotten his name. The the fantastic striker that we signed that scored that dramatic hat-trick against Reading University. What was his name? Oh, Bissaya.
Oh, Cedric Bissaya.
Oh, dear. So, yeah, don't accuse me of rose-tinting the old era. I remember it just as in some of the bad as well as the good there. That just about, I think... Gents, unless you've got anything particularly to raise before we sign off, I've got one final question for you, but before I ask that, anything else?
No, I enjoyed that little reminisce package down Reading Wade.
Yeah.
The old Reading Way.
Yeah, we'll carry it on for half an hour.
Well, we've got to save something for pub chats next season. Got to leave something for the listeners to want more. But okay, so my final question is, Yap Stam has signed ostensibly a 3-year contract. Is Yap Stam here in 3 years' time, yes or no?
No, because if he does well, he'll probably go elsewhere.
Next Man United manager, isn't he?
Oh, well, poor Giggsy.
When Mourinho gets a boot, inevitably gets the sack.
In about 6 months.
He's been sacked almost everywhere he's been, isn't he, Mourinho? Despite his trophy-laden success.
I don't think he's managed anywhere longer than 3 years, Mourinho.
Yeah, 3.5 he got at Chelsea once, that's about it. So, today, what do you reckon? Is he in 3 years' time?
No.
I'm also going to say no, but I tend to hope for Johnny's.
No, I hope he is, but as long as he does well, I hope he is, but I can't see it.
It'll either be, that's the thing, he'll either be poached or he'll be not well enough and get sacked.
The proof in the pudding for him will be if he can do it on a Tuesday night in Burton.
Indeed.
Rafa v Stam.
Di Matteo v Stam. We've also got an all Dutch affair in the championship with Stam v Hasselbank.
That'd be good.
So there you go.
Attack v defence.
A real orange tint to our Hoops derby.
De Aranha.
Well, anyway, the fixtures are out in just over a week's time, and there is plenty to get involved with. No pre-season tour of Slovakia. There's lots of
Slovenia
even.
My mother would be very angry if you called her country Slovakia.
I apologise, yeah. Mrs. Williams. I know you've completely sent my train of thought, but anyway, there is lots of things happening over the summer at Reading Football Club. We will be back. We are going nowhere. That's a complete lie. We're going somewhere for about 3 or 4 weeks, but we will be back. We're not going somewhere for good. I will be back with Charles hopefully at the end of this week or next. We'll sort of get the inside track from Charles, who was in the news conference with Yap Stam and who has spoken to him, to sort of get his early impressions of the new Reading manager. So stay tuned for that. We'll all be back in a few weeks' time when there's again a bit more news to chew over. This sort of really wraps up, as mentioned, the sort of Brian McDermott tenure. I don't really want to spend too much more time looking back. It's kind of in the past. I'm sure his name's going to get brought up again. But again, thank you to Brian. And thank you to everyone who's continued to listen. Thank you to everyone who sent in tweets and said it wasn't a very well publicised show. It was sort of organised on the fly. But hopefully you've been entertained over the last hour and a half. And if you do want to give your support to the show, our crowdfunding campaign is still open. You can find details for that attached to the post that goes up with this show. And just in general, especially if you've got time, give us a rating on iTunes, leave a comment, or just, you know, send us a tweet or something. It's all very much appreciated and helps us get through. Do apologise if the audio quality has been slightly below what it has been throughout the season. We're down to a one mic setup, still in our temporary home. My new house isn't going to be built for another couple of weeks yet. I wasn't expecting to do a show. I wasn't expecting a sacking. So most of the audio equipment is in a box packed away. So thank you.
Unprofessional joke of the podcast.
You wouldn't have it any other way, would you?
And you've now got a chant.
You do. Feel free to sing it at me. We'll come on to Yap chants and much more later on. So please keep those thoughts coming into all the usual channels. But in the meantime,
and we'll do it for Peter Matte. We'll win the league at Ewood Park.
You ask.